Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Sitting across the table, we've got Mr. John Copenhaver. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, Al. How are you?
I'm delicious.
Oh, wow. Great.
I know. It's been an interesting year already, like I said. Be back down recording with Sundance for a four-part series and got a Discovery Channel option. So I've been doing well, actually.
That's amazing. I am so pleased to hear it. I think that's super cool.
So am I. It's what I didn't expect. So, you know, take it as it comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now we've got a great, great guest again tonight. His new novel, Child Zero, will be coming out here shortly. And we've got Mr. Chris Holm. Thank you for being here, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wow, this is quite the novel here. Very, very fitting to our time. I was sort of surprised when I got it at first, and then what brought you to write this story? Like, this was not meant to coincide with COVID, was it?
No, very much not. In fact, I began writing Child Zero in 2016, right after my last book came out, which was the second in my Hendrix series, Red Right Hand. And in fact, I had been kicking around ideas for what I wanted to tackle next with my agent, who's a terrific collaborator. And I kept throwing ideas at him. And he's like, yeah, that's interesting. That's, you know, I had a sort of escape novel, you know, that I wanted to write. It was going to take place on a Rikers Island type jail facility. And he was like, yeah, you know, that could be interesting. And I pitched a couple other things. And then I said, you know, but what I really love, and unfortunately I have no idea how to write, is a thriller that takes place in a post-antibiotic world. And there was this long pause on the phone. And my agent, David, said, tell me more about that. What does that mean? And it was really from that genesis that Child Zero came. My background outside of writing, I spent about 15 years making my living as a molecular biologist. So I have a fairly strong handle on the science. But I really, where I struggled in conceptualizing Child Zero was I didn't want to write something that was dry and scientific. I wanted to write a pedal to the metal action thriller that maybe illuminated for an audience that didn't understand what a post-antibiotic world might look like, just what a terrifying new normal that could be. So that was my initial spark for this book. And because it's so research heavy, it took the better part of 4 or 5 years for me to get a draft that I was happy with. A draft that my first draft of the novel was finished in early January of 2020. And if you recall, early January of 2020 is when COVID exploded from a few cases in Wuhan to the beginnings of what we're still dealing with right now. So I had no thought of releasing a pandemic novel during a pandemic. So it'll be curious to see how that goes.
Well, yeah, because I'm not sure how you would handle this in your book, but the way the world has reacted to this COVID has been, I think, somewhat unexpected by several people. You know, the whole major conspiracies of, and that it's fake or it's made up or it was planned, and there's all of these things going around the world, and then you got the rallies and the anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers and stuff. So with all of that going on and taking so much attention, I don't know. Does that worry you any?
So it doesn't. It doesn't. I think there are a couple of ways to look at that. I mean, if you recall, early on in the pandemic, when we were all, completely scared out of our wits about going outside, and we were sanitizing our groceries, the number one movie on most streaming platforms was Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film. Right. So it's fascinating to me that I think there is an appetite for a pandemic fiction of a sort. And I also think that where I perhaps, I should say that the bones of the novel were 100% there before COVID hit. I changed very, very little to address maybe the way that things unfolded slightly differently than I would have envisioned due to the COVID pandemic. But now my writing doesn't look as much like prognostication as it does perhaps a reflection of the reality that we would see in a pandemic environment. So I felt pretty good about my predictions. I think where I'm going to take a ding is I no longer look like I'm some sort of brilliant futurist predicting these things, but where I might gain a little credit is in the accuracy of my prediction. Very little needed changing. And I think, I think it's important to note this isn't a COVID novel. It's actually not about a virus per se, although a virus does play a role in it. It really is about something much bigger that the scientific community has been clamoring about for the better part of a decade now, but that has really not gotten its hooks into the public consciousness. And so for me, the real goal is to maybe change some hearts and minds and make people realize, wow, these threats of a post-antibiotic era are legitimate and very, very frightening.
Yeah, I actually remember. I've heard that enough. It seemed to be something that was being talked about, and COVID sort of took away the news, really, or the medical news. But I still wonder if there's a lot of anti-science has really developed over the last couple of years and become very public. And I wonder if that, you being 15 years of being in science, does that take you aback somewhat when you look at the response to just scientific notions and science in itself? And does that change the way you kind of outlook in your book?
So what's interesting is in the book, I think you see a reflection of societal skepticism about science. You see a lot of fear mongering. You see some people who are actually embracing the sort of pandemic of pandemics that the book portrays. So I think everyone likes to believe that the era that in which they live is unique, and obviously in many respects each era is. But it's worth noting that a lot of these sort of anti-science sentiments, anti-vaccine sentiments, governmental overreach sentiments, distrust, those things have been baked into the culture for a very long time. We saw the same thing during the Spanish influenza in 1918, and not for nothing. It raged for 3 years, not just one, in large part because, people lacked the full understanding of the scope of what was happening. They lacked the will to follow basic antiseptic protocols. Obviously, back then, vaccines were not as big an issue. But I do think, as a scientist, one of the reasons that this book was so intriguing to me is, to be frank, there aren't a lot of scientists in my realm, the molecular biologists, the ones who toil away in the lab playing with things like nucleic acid, proteins. There aren't a lot of us who are very good at communicating. You see a lot of naturalists on TV, but nobody is doing the thrilling narration of the sorts of science that go on in a lab. And I think that there is an onus upon scientists to maybe prosecute their case a little better. I think scientists as a whole need to get better at explaining to people what our conclusions are, but also how we got to them. We need to address concerns. We need to have some sense of how the public receives our message, which makes my book sound like it's going to be an academic textbook, and it's very much not. In fact, I think it's the early praise that I've gotten has largely called it terrifying and thrilling, which I don't think is how many people would describe molecular biology.
So let's talk about the premise of the book now, so people kind of know. And I know that you talk about bacterial infections and the whole antibiotic resistance, and that plays a very key role in this. So let's maybe discuss that for a second.
Sure. That's actually, it's a really fascinating area. And in fact, I hope I'm not offending anybody, but I suspect all of us on this chat are old enough to have been told, make sure you take your full course of antibiotics, because if you don't, you could end up with a breakthrough infection. That was sort of the received knowledge for how resistant infections came about when antibiotics first debuted. So, for example, penicillin debuted in 1941. Penicillin-resistant infections were seen as early as 1942. And so what people thought was, oh, well, that guy just skipped his last couple of doses. A couple of hardy bugs hung on, and then they divided, and those divided, and those divided, and now this guy's got a new infection. But by the late 1950s, doctors started seeing infections that were resistant to drugs that the patient had never even been treated with before. And a terrifying truth began to take shape. This is where things get complicated and sciencey, but I promise this is as much science as I'm going to throw at you. Bacteria, like humans, are susceptible to viruses. They get sick just like we do. But the bacteria, the viruses that affect bacteria, have this really funny habit of plucking genetic material out of one bacterium and then injecting it into the next one. They basically pick it up when they reproduce. They pop the bacteria and all the virus goes flooding all over the place. And they kind of carry little bits of genetic material every time they do that. And what's really wild about that is when they then bump into another bacterium, they can essentially introduce that genetic material exactly the same as bees cross-pollinating flowers. Now that sounds complicated, but what it means in a nutshell is that any bacterium that bumps into an antibiotic and survives has the capacity to teach any other bacteria on the planet, even those of different species, how to do the same thing. And that is really, really chilling. I think most people have this notion that antibiotics, you know, you have a sore throat, you go to the doc, he gives you a course of antibiotics, you know, you go home. And that's really the extent of our exposure to antibiotics, but that's not the case at all. Before antibiotics, two of the biggest killers in this country were tuberculosis and pneumonia. They vanished virtually overnight from the top 10 killers in the United States once antibiotics were invented. If antibiotics start to fail, those come surging back. But beyond that, you're also going to see things like the risk of post-surgical infections will basically destroy modern medicine. You won't be able to transplant organs anymore. You won't be able to perform implant surgeries like hip implants or cosmetic implants. Steroids, radiation, and chemotherapy are going to have to be like dramatically curtailed because they decimate the immune system. And this sounds like, you know, a thriller writer trying to come up with these creepy examples to make things sound terrifying. But in fact, I have a couple of quotes that I think are worth noting. In a 2014 World Health Organization report, physician Keiji Fukuda wrote, "A post-antibiotic era in which common infections and minor injuries can kill, far from being an apocalyptic fantasy, is instead a very real possibility for the 21st century." That was in 2014. In 2019, the CDC director said, "Stop referring to a coming post-antibiotic era. It's already here. You and I are living in a time when some miracle drugs no longer perform miracles, and families are being ripped apart by a microscopic enemy." In a 2021 editorial for the journal Science, two professors cautioned, "Unless researchers develop new antibiotics and therapeutics, the decimation of modern medicine will soon become a reality." And that's to say nothing of the fact that our modern factory farms are very dependent on antibiotics. They use fully 80% of the antibiotics produced, mostly prophylactically, so they can keep animals in smaller areas and keep up with demand. So if antibiotics fail on a broad scale, we lose the capacity to treat things like cancer or failing organs. We lose the capacity to raise enough livestock to support our current eating habits. We're looking at losing a lot of fruit to blight. So you're going to start to see mass starvation. You're going to start to see skirmishes over scarcity. It really is going to have these global ripples that are going to seismically change what the world looks like. And I think most people have no handle on just how serious that's going to be. In fact, the UN estimates we'll see 10 million deaths per year from multi-drug resistant bacteria by 2050. And that's to say nothing of things like starvation or cancer or anything like that that'll be impacted. So it's a really scary new normal that we'd be facing down if this comes to pass.
Well, how am I going to get my facelift?
Isn't that the question? I mean, you know, yeah. I say that as somebody who is, and I know I sound and am a giant nerd, but I'm also pretty heavily tattooed. And that's another thing that's going to go away if antibiotics are no longer broadly functional. Is, you know, anything that's gonna cause open wounds, like a tattoo, like a lot of piercings, like cosmetic surgeries, absolutely. It'll be an interesting time. And, you know, it in some ways will be a return to a Victorian era in terms of disease. And in other ways, it'll actually be far worse because, you know, you couldn't hop on a plane with plague and travel around the world during its incubation period, spreading it everywhere you go. That can happen in the 21st century.
Right. Right. So when you take something so, I guess serious to people and something that's very possible like this, something that we're sort of in the midst of, how are you able to explain that to them in a book, in a novel without it being too, as you were saying, dry? Like, how do you incorporate stories to get people to understand the meaning behind it rather than just them getting infected and dying?
Right. So that was actually my biggest challenge. It was like, okay, the post-antibiotic thriller is sort of a premise in need of a plot. And so for me, all writing stems from character. And so I really needed to root this story in believable characters. And I had a few things that I wanted to accomplish when I sort of set out to break this book down. One of them was I did not want to have any laboratory scientists as characters in the book. I didn't want any talking heads that, you know, are just sitting there staring into a microscope, because I think people tune out with things like that. I wanted it to take place in the real world as much as I could. And I do have a medical doctor as one of the characters who's able to get some of these ideas across simply. But the story is this. The book actually takes place not as antibiotics are failing, but about 4 years after antibiotics have failed on a broad scale. Three years after a heinous bioterror attack on New York City. And one of the reasons I was so interested in that was the United States government does a lot of modeling of what a bioterror attack might look like. And the model organism they most often use is a bacteria called Yersinia pestis, Y. pestis, which is responsible for causing bubonic plague, septicemic plague, and pneumonic plague. And they use that as their model organism because it's very easy to cultivate. And without proper treatment, it's quite deadly. I say without proper treatment, pneumonic plague, unlike the other two, doesn't require an animal vector for transmission. So humans can pass it to each other through the air. With timely access to antibiotics, you can cure about 95% of pneumonic plague cases. Without antibiotics, no one with pneumonic plague will last a week. It will be 100% fatal. So in my world, they're still reeling from an attack that happened several years ago. And as a consequence of the attack, there's actually a refugee camp in the sheep meadow of Central Park in New York. These people who were stranded when the attack happened and forced into temporary FEMA housing, and then kind of became a political football, because now they're there, they're living in these squalid conditions where they're exposed to all kinds of nasty diseases, and nobody wants to let them out. And so my book is about a murder that takes place, a mass murder of a village within this encampment. And so one of the major point of view characters is a cop, is a detective named Jacob Gibson. He and his partner show up to investigate this murder. And what they discover fairly early on is that despite the fact that these people basically live in a tiny third world country right in the middle of New York City, not a single person who died had anything medically wrong with them, which is a near impossibility in the world that I've created. And then you find out that a 12-year-old boy who is one of the residents of this camp managed to escape and is now on the run from whoever is responsible for this attack. And so the question becomes, how is it that these people manage to stay healthy? What does this boy know, or what is he carrying with him, or what can he do that makes him so desirable to the people chasing him? And that was really my lens. I really wanted to focus on a crime. There's a strong child in peril plot. It's also, there's a lot of sociopolitical aspects to the novel, because the boy in question, Mateo Rivas, is a mestizo child who is in the country as an asylum seeker. And so, you know, you have a lot of power structures. You have these power structures. You have bad guys all around, some governmental, some extra-governmental, all who want to get their hands on this young brown kid. And that allowed me to explore a lot of thorny issues involving bodily autonomy when it comes to persecuted minorities, which is something that I think we as scientists and as a culture very much need to reckon with.
You know, I think that just hearing you talk, you have so many different facets. Certainly the research, even with your background, must have taken a while to do. And I'm curious sort of as the, you know, it sounds like you kind of started with an idea that the narrative developed, but what was the process like going back between crafting the story, the hook that's going to take us through this, and then doing all this robust research? How did you navigate that?
Poorly, I think, is the answer to that. So I really love the research aspect of a novel, and I don't just mean the big questions, right? Like, you know, how does multi-drug resistance occur? I mean things like, you know, how to pick a lock, or, you know, any I'm just fascinated by all of the mechanical questions that one needs to answer when you sit down to write a book. So I have a tendency to fall down rabbit holes, and for me it was really key to hone in on what I wanted this book to be about, which was about this thrilling story of a boy being chased, a cop trying to find out what's going on, and then intersecting with this kid, and then he and his partner get swept up sort of in these larger wheels that are turning. And so I really tried to keep it focused on that, but I found that in the case of this book, I couldn't do all of the research and then sit down and write it. I really had to research as I went. And I think that tends to narrow the scope of the research that needs doing. You know, if I'm writing, I'm not somebody to, you know, not one of those writers who can put like a little description TK and then move on, hoping that I'll fill it in later. I really need to have those details down to write the scene, because I feel like they inform the scene. And so it was for a long time a very slow, grueling process. This is by far the longest I've ever taken to write a book. I think before that, you know, my prior book I wrote in 9 months. This one took 5 years, essentially. And I think I threw out more words than the book actually contains, in part because I was building out the world and imagining what a world would look like, you know, in which this story would take place. And then I found that a lot of it, although interesting from a world building point of view, didn't move the story forward. So I.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Cut viciously because I really wanted it to motor. And it really, you know, it's not even a terribly long book. It's not a doorstop. It's about 350 pages. And one hopes that it moves pretty quickly. I always think of that maxim that easy reading is hard writing. And in this case, I don't know if it's easy reading. I suppose that's for everyone else to decide, but I can confirm that it was hard writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like always difficulty. I do sort of a lot of historical research, but how much to put in and how much to leave out, and then also to what degree it informs the plot. Did you have any moments where you felt like, I have to take this a different direction because of this detail or this information or discovery you made while researching any aspect of it?
Oh, gosh. So many times, in fact. In fact, the central conceit, this idea that the mechanism behind this widespread antibiotic resistance is a virus known as the Harbinger virus in the book, which is essentially an ancient virus that affects bacteria that was trapped in the permafrost in Siberia. Climate change releases it, and it begins to rapidly spread until it essentially blankets the globe, becoming one of the most common viruses on the planet in a matter of weeks. And this particular virus is a real class of virus known as a super spreader, which is really, really good at taking genes from one bacterium and sticking them in another one. And I had some handle on how these sorts of drug resistance things happened, but I didn't really realize how dangerous it would be if one of these viruses went wide, because then it's not just a matter of these bugs have already adapted to what we have, so we better get some more drugs in the pipeline. Once something like that, once that genie is out of the bottle, they will continue to adapt so rapidly that we're behind the curve and can't possibly catch up. Any drug we develop will be overrun in record time. And when I fell down the rabbit hole of these super spreader viruses, I found it genuinely chilling. And again, my background is in molecular biology, but I originally, before I turned to writing, wanted to be a bug hunter for the CDC, a disease detective. One of the people that they would send to investigate and hopefully stop an outbreak of something like Ebola or cholera. Those things don't scare me. This scared me. I had to kind of sit back and say, whoa, this is worse than I thought. And so that was, I think, the key realization early on in my process, where I realized, okay, that drives every choice from here on out. And then I read a report, a government bioterror drill report that basically modeled out what a Y. pestis attack would look like in Denver, Colorado, and they did a digital sort of facsimile of what a simple aerosol device that could easily be built would do for dispersal at a stadium during a game. And they did an analysis that I think ended up with between 15,000 and 30,000 dead. And that was counting on antibiotics to sort of stem the tide. And so that was another one where I was like, oh, that's got to make it into the book. And then on a lighter note, and this is completely true, penicillin was such a hot ticket item when it first debuted, because of course, bear in mind, this was 1941. You're talking about World War II. it was in such demand that doctors were collecting the urine of American GIs so that they could readminister the penicillin that these people were secreting to other patients. And yes, readminister means exactly what you think it means. And I was like, well, that's just a bizarre detail. That's got to go in the book somewhere. And it ends up there's a black market bazaar in the book. That's one of my favorite set pieces, in which a very shady character is selling some peculiar tinctures, jars of medicine, as he would call them, that are taken directly from the no flow eco toilets of the very wealthy who have access to better drugs.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, there are so many peculiar and interesting things that you come across when you're looking into the development of antibiotics, when you're looking into just some of the characters that were responsible for these studies. And we tend to think of this as ancient history, but again, I'm only going back into the middle of the last century. We're still in a very narrow window of this remarkable era of antibiotics. And unfortunately, if we're not careful, it'll be the end of that era very soon.
So, like, I know that you were writing this a lot before the pandemic, but did that just kind of freak you out?
Yeah, it absolutely did. Scientists for the longest time have been warning of this sort of thing precisely, and yet it's still a bit of a shock to see it unfold in real time. Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things I was kicking myself for was I had everybody in my book using disposable masks. And early in the pandemic, everybody immediately pivoted to cloth masks. And I thought, darn, well, that's something I got wrong. And then it turns out as things got more communicable, we all started going to more aggressive filtration masks and single use masks. So I was like, oh, okay, maybe I was right after all. But yeah, it was disheartening. It was also dispiriting, honestly, because when you're writing something this potentially scary, you really don't want to be right. I would have loved it if this were a terrific hook for a novel that 20 years from now proved, you know, an unnecessary warning. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you were speaking, I kept on thinking, oh my gosh, I can't imagine doing all this research and digging into all this material and then, you know, actually being faced with a pandemic. I know it's not the same situation, but still.
It's not at all the same situation. And yet, you know, obviously, a lot of the warnings in the book about this threat that we don't see coming, you know, transposed pretty directly on what we saw with the coronavirus. I mean, you know, I think any time we narrowly avert something like this, we don't think, whew, close call. We think, oh, well, we got excited about nothing. You know, it's like when they predict a terrible winter storm and you get a half an inch of snow, it doesn't seem so bad. You know, but we had dry runs of this with SARS. And I don't mean to suggest that SARS wasn't frightening. If you were in the affected region, it was terrifying and it did kill, I think in the high hundreds to low thousands people, which is no small loss. But unfortunately, we didn't learn the right lessons from that because, you know, watching COVID tear across the world like wildfire was sobering, to say the least. And John, I think I'm going to take a page out of your book now. I think the next book I write is going to have to be something at least a little historical. I'm eyeing the early 80s in my case, because I'm not sure I want to predict what the, you know, something in the next couple of years will look like, because we're all still trying to figure out this new normal. And speaking of historical fiction, John, I'm about 80 pages into The Savage Kind, and it is absolutely marvelous.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you like it.
It's terrific. I have for a variety of really boring businessy reasons, been stuck editing and re-editing portions of Child Zero for the past few months, and so I haven't had as much time to pleasure read as I normally do. So now that I finally got the book locked, I'm back with a vengeance, really plowing into the TBR pile, and yours was very near the top.
I can't wait for the summer. As I teach school, I have very little time to do much extracurricular reading, so I'm just chomping mm-hmm. to get some time to do that. I hear you on that one.
So how did this change you, looking back at it, going through this whole 5 years of putting together this book and now getting it finally done and completed, and going through all the experiences you must have gone through to get here, how do you think it's changed you?
I think it's changed me in a lot of ways, actually. I think, I mean, if you can imagine, at 5 years, this is essentially a PhD thesis, or as if I, wrote one paper for all of college. It was such a deep dive into one topic that I really, I felt like a monk for a lot of it, where I was just holed up doing this research and writing this thing. And I just kept telling people, just you wait. And I'm trying to, whenever you try to explain a novel in progress, you sound like some crazy person trying to relate a half-remembered fever dream. So I had this sense that, I'm really onto something here. But every time I tried to tell people about it, I just got these blank looks. And so it is fun to be a little bit vindicated now that we're nearing publication. I mean, I've gotten lovely feedback from Lee Child, called it intense, propulsive and provocative, and highly recommended. Tess Gerritsen called it a terrifying look at a world gone mad and the possible plagues to come. So I feel vindicated in that sense, that I took this deep dive, and that it's to some extent paying off. But I also think it was humbling to me, as somebody who's throughout my career has been, I think, something of a restless storyteller. I had a trilogy that was sort of cross genre as my first three novels that blended fantasy and pulp crime. And then my last two novels, The Killing Kind and Red Right Hand for Mulholland, were hitman stories. They're about a hitman who only killed other hitmen. So for me, this was about reconciling the day job portion of most of my adult life, as a biologist, with my passion, for crime writing and thrillers. And so that was interesting. That was a journey. To try and figure out how to meld those two in a way that, hopefully is a thrilling ride for readers who don't care about the science. That's my goal, for people who just don't care about the science to love this book. So that was a long and humbling journey. But more than that, I think I suffered from a case of writer's block after Red Right Hand, for a number of reasons. And it took me a little while to get over that. So I think I learned a lot about myself, in the process of tackling that. So that was a powerful lesson as well, to kind of start from where I felt I was starting from nothing. Like I just, the muse wasn't whispering in my ear, so to speak. And I wasn't, the stories that normally rattled around in my head had fallen silent. And then to have to build myself back up and figure out how to do this job again. So it was, I think cathartic is an understatement when it comes to finally seeing this book get some positive press.
So when someone picks up the book, takes it home and reads it, what is it that you want them to take away from it?
There are a number of things I'd like them to take away from it. But first and foremost, I know we've been science heavy in this interview, but first and foremost, whenever I sit down to write anything, all I want to do is tell a thrilling yarn. That's it. My personal feeling is I have to compete not just with other novels for people's attention. And believe me, I do not think writing is a zero-sum game. I love championing other writers' work, and I don't mean competing in any sort of negative sense. But I'm also clamoring for their attention with their phones, their social media, more streaming than you can shake a stick at. So if I'm going to write a story and put it out into the world, I want to do my level best to make sure it is as engaging as humanly possible for the duration, right? I just want people to be thrilled by it. I want them to have an experience like they did back during the heyday of Michael Crichton, where maybe, just maybe, they'll learn something about a topic they knew nothing about, come away with a greater understanding, but they'll do it by going on a thrill ride. I mean, I don't think a lot of people had a great handle on DNA before Jurassic Park. And if you want to teach people about DNA and cloning, dinosaurs is a great spoonful of sugar to help that medicine go down. And in my case, I don't have dinosaurs, but I do have a really thrilling story about a little kid, very smart and resourceful, but again, a little kid with you know, few allies in this world, being hunted by government operatives and by these extra governmental people who want to get their hands on him for their own nefarious purposes. I hope that they just enjoy it, and I hope it sparks questions about the way we use antibiotics now and how we could maybe use them better. And I also, again, it's one of the things I touched on earlier. I think there are a lot of unreasonable reasons why people are vaccine hesitant, for example, or anti-vaxxers. But scientists and public officials need to acknowledge that there are also valid reasons for certain segments of our population to be dubious about the medical establishment and authorities. I'm speaking specifically about people of color in this country who have time and time again seen their bodily autonomy violated. And I'm not only talking about, you know, historically. I mean, I'm talking as recently as, you know, 2019 or so, there was a whistleblower talking about a doctor at an ICE facility who was sterilizing women without their knowledge or consent. Incarcerated people in Alabama being tested on with unproven COVID vaccines when, you know, the vast majority of people incarcerated in Alabama are African-American, despite the fact that they do not make up the majority of the Alabama population. So I do have these thorny things in there that I want people to be aware of. But if it's not wrapped up in a thrilling yarn, it's just, I wouldn't ask people to read it, and I wouldn't expect them to.
Well, how did you develop your characters, like the kid that they're all trying to find, and about your detective, Jacob Gibson? How do you get into the mind enough of a character like that, that isn't real, that reads as something very real?
Well, I think, you know, in a lot of respects, I have the benefit of reading very widely, which is important. Particularly, this book is an incredibly diverse book in terms of its cast. And obviously, I would never misrepresent myself to anyone as a person of color. I am a straight white cis male, so I'm aware that I'm writing these characters from a place of privilege. And I think that, you know, you need to, especially as a writer writing from a place of privilege, you need to do your research, and you need to seek out firsthand accounts from people who have the lived experiences that you're attempting to portray. You need to read fiction by writers of color and underrepresented writers. One thing I found that was really handy for me, because this book takes place in the near future, it takes place in 2031. I had this realization early on in my research that a lot of the adults in the book are children now, or were children in the aughts to teens. And so, for example, there's a character in the book, Amira Hassan. She's my main character, Jacob Gibson's partner. She is a hijabi woman who is a New York City police detective. I based her in part on a young woman who was the first sworn officer of the Portland, Maine PD to be from our Somali community, which we have a large Somali community. But also, when I wanted to understand why a young, modern Muslim woman would choose to wear the hijab and how she would approach wearing her hijab and what she felt that portrayed to the world, I found it really useful that there are so many young, savvy hijabi women who have had vlogs on YouTube about their experiences, who have written extensively about them. So I take the research very seriously. But again, I would never dare suggest that it could make up for lived experience. So, you know, I would hate to take up any oxygen that is better served for writers of color. But
So now, are you into the new world of doing social media? And do you have a website? How do you like people to get in contact with you?
Oh gosh, so I started my career as a writer in around 2006, which I kind of think of as the blog era. So I've been pretty active on social media and online since 06. You can find me on the web at chrisholmbooks.com. You can find me on Twitter at chrisfholm.com. You can find me on Facebook at chrisholmbooks. As far as I know, I don't have a TikTok or a Snapchat, so you know, you won't see any dance moves or anything like that from me. But I do try and keep people entertained on Twitter as best I can. That's probably the best place to interact with me with some regularity, because I'm always looking to avoid something, you know, whether it's research or work or cleaning the house. Yeah. So I'm frequently on Twitter.
Well, we'll get you set up on TikTok, you know.
There you go.
You get up there.
Teach me some dance moves.
Yeah, do some dance moves. You and John could do like a thing and hold books. And
apparently, there are a lot of TikTokers that are selling books. I did not realize this, but my publicist told me so. And I said, I'm sorry. I just can't do another social media.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know, book talk? Yeah.
I've been amazed by that. My wife is a reviewer. My wife, Katrina Needles Holm, reviews for a number of outlets, including Publishers Weekly. And she tends to do a lot of interviews within the YA realm for authors as they come through, as their release dates near. And one of her recent interviews, they talked about how this woman's backlist suddenly hit the bestseller list because somebody on Book Talk had kind of latched on to one of her titles and had been promoting it, and it essentially went viral. It's remarkable, and it's an amazing tool. I think, you know, every writer has to decide for themselves how much social media and what social media works for them. In my case, Twitter's a little more natural than say Facebook, because I like sort of the cocktail, you know, party aspect of it, getting to chat with people. I wish it were maybe a little less strident than it is these days. I am also on Instagram. I haven't figured out how to use it to sell books, but if you want to see pictures of local Maine beer and my cats, you can find me at Chris Holm Books on Instagram as well.
Well, we'll have all that up on the website so people can find you with just one click and get at it, you know? So do you like this change of social media and people being able to interact with you so easily?
I do, actually. I've had overwhelmingly positive interactions on social media. I also think, you know, as a fledgling writer, social media led me to a lot of my early credits. A lot of my good friends who were maybe had online magazines or were launching print magazines would just hit me up because, you know, they knew me as a short story writer at the time. I got about 30 short stories to my name these days. And you know, they would say, "Hey, I'm starting this new project. You want to write me something?" And it was a great way to just connect with other people who geek out over the same stuff I geek out over. You know, eventually, I think eventually anybody with a big enough audience is going to get a few trolls, and I have, largely for my politics. I've had people object to having trans characters in my books, to having queer characters in general. And And that's fine. I found a great way to shut them up is to donate to GLAAD in their name. they stopped jawing at you very quickly. If you said, thanks so much for the feedback, I just made a donation in your name. But even that allows you to make some hay out of it. And you know, I try not to take too strong of a political stance in my books. And I do hope that I piss off people on both sides of the aisle on occasion. But there's no question I trend progressive. And certainly that has led me to a couple of odd encounters on the internet.
Oh, yeah, I've got plenty. I can share some.
Although I will tell you, my personal belief is the nastiest messages that you will get as a writer come from the male half of an older married couple that share an email address. If you ever get an email from like Bob and Cindy at hotmail.com or whatever, you can be guaranteed that they are going to have a nasty message for you about something in your novel that they didn't care for.
That's a good thing to look out for. So,
where Bob and Cindy.
Yeah, there you go.
And now I feel bad because I plucked those names out of the air. Yeah. For all I know, there's a perfectly lovely Bob and Cindy at Hotmail that are.
Yeah, they're going to be after you now. So,
apologies, Bob and Cindy.
Yeah, there we go. Well, this has been a great conversation. You certainly are a very interesting person. So now the book we're talking about is Child Zero, and it's a novel. It's written by Chris Holm. Again, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a kick.
Take care, Chris.
Get the latest news and opinions from Eric Shapiro from the House of Mystery website in the Shapiro Report.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.